Questions of Faith, Lecture 9, Hell.
It may seem very strange for anyone but a fundamentalist to spend a whole lecture in the philosophy of religion on the concept of hell. Here's my justification for doing that. First, for most people, it's the strongest objection to the traditional theistic view of life after death, the hardest religious doctrine to swallow, and the first one to be abandoned. Bertrand Russell, one of the most famous and intelligent atheistic philosophers of the 20th century, saw hell as the most obvious reason for disbelief in Christianity, in his famous essay, Why I Am Not a Christian. Second, it qualifies as what William James called a live option, an idea that's worth thinking about because it makes a great difference to our lives, whether we decide to accept it or reject it. Not only is there an infinite difference between the idea of heaven and the idea of hell, but there's a great difference between the idea of both and the idea of neither. That is, between a life that's headed towards that razor-edged choice and one that isn't. If there's no hell, life's choices make only a finite, temporal difference. If there's hell, they make an infinite and eternal difference. And there's an infinite difference between a finite difference and an infinite difference. Believing in hell may be irrational, neurotic, or even immoral, but it's certainly interesting. It gives life that razor edge and maximum drama. So there are existential reasons for examining it. Third, there are logical reasons for examining it. It's part and parcel of all three theistic religions. So to reject hell logically presupposes that whatever religious authority teaches the reality of hell, scripture, tradition, Jesus, the Quran, is not infallible. And that seems to undermine the very source of religious authority for everything else in the religion, including the nice stuff like God's love and mercy, which is just as surprising and just as hard to prove by logic or empirical experience alone. Let's look at the logic here for a moment. Why does anyone believe that God loves them? Is there a syllogism that proves that? Is it logically self-evident that the being who has no needs loves these superfluous creatures? That the being who is perfectly just goes beyond justice and loves us more than we justly deserve? Or is there some observation of nature that proves divine love? Nature red in tooth and claw? Or some scientific experiment? Or history, which Hegel calls the great slaughter bench? Even moral conscience doesn't show that God loves us. Conscience is hard as nails. It tells us we are absolutely obligated to do right and not wrong, but it doesn't tell us whether we're forgiven. No, there's only one reason why anyone ever came to the conclusion that God is merciful and compassionate, and that's religious faith. Belief in some divine revelation, in the character of God as revealed in the Torah, in the Gospels, or in the Quran. And that's the very same reason for believing in hell. Logically, you either accept both ideas on the grounds of that authority, or you reject both, for they both stand on that same ground. If the authority can be wrong about hell, it can be wrong about anything else. And if you say you believe in one of those three religions, but you don't believe in hell, that means you're presupposing the principle that you can change whatever religious teachings you find unacceptable, which is perfectly right in philosophy, where everything has to come under the bar of human reason. But if you extend that principle to religion, then you don't have revealed religion anymore. You don't have faith as distinct from reason. If there is a divine revelation, as these three religions claim, then that divine revelation must tell us some things that we couldn't discover or prove by our own reason. Otherwise, it makes no sense to call those things divine revelation. If at the other extreme, those ideas that are supposed to be divine revelations are so irrational that they contradict reason, really contradict reason, logically and not just psychologically and emotionally, if there are logical proofs that they're false, well, then no honest and intelligent person can believe them anymore because reason has refuted them. So it's essential to the concept of religious faith that we can't prove it all by reason and also that we can't disprove any of it. And of all the teachings within religious faith, hell seems to most people to be the one that we can disprove the most easily. So this is a critical test case for the philosophy of religion, not some flaky, weird obsession. One more reason for examining this unpopular idea is that two other very popular ideas are closely connected with it: free will and a real distinction between good and evil. Now, certainly many people believe in free will and the distinction between good and evil without believing in hell, but the defenders of hell argue that it is illogical to do that. If there is no hell, then ultimately there is no free will and ultimately no distinction between good and evil. So these concepts are involved in the argument. They're two premises for one of the arguments for hell. By contrast, in Eastern pantheism, there is ultimately no hell and no free will and no ultimate dualism between good and evil, whereas in Western religions there is. Well, here are 18 objections to the idea of hell, 18 arguments against the concept. The first one is very simple. It's the thing most intelligent people will say if you ask them whether they believe in hell. You got to be kidding. It's simply ridiculous. Argument isn't necessary. Common sense finds a literal hell intolerable and incredible. So the wisest thing to say about hell is, to hell with hell. Even if the defender of hell finds some clever ways to explain away the self-evident absurdity of the idea by making some theological or philosophical distinctions, those answers won't be convincing. They're like sandcastles, but the objection is like a big wave. But the only way to answer arguments is with things like distinctions. The objector is making any answer impossible by calling logical distinctions mere sandcastles, and that would be substituting name-calling for argument. Our instinctive denial of hell doesn't prove anything, any more than our instinctive denial of death does. If you go to the doctor today feeling fine and you're told you have only a few weeks to live, your instinctive reaction would be denial, but you're not the doctor. Perhaps our instinctive refusal to believe this doctrine comes partly from confusing the doctrine with the imagery, which is silly if interpreted literally. The same is true of heaven. The doctrine is not tied to the images of golden streets or fluffy clouds. So let's state the obvious objection to hell. It makes nonsense of the idea that God is love. Belief in hell is not only illogical but wicked. It makes God a cosmic hypocrite. In Christianity especially, but also in Hasidic Judaism and Sufi Islam, God is pure love. And we're supposed to be godlike and loving, even to our enemies, and forgiving and merciful and compassionate, even to those who don't deserve it. And yet God sends people to hell. Doesn't matter how many, one is quite enough, because he is also a God of wrath. Wrath means hate, and hate is the opposite of love. And it's simply a contradiction to say that God is pure love if he is also a God of hate. The only possible answer to this objection is to deny the premise that God has literal wrath. And that's what the saints and mystics usually do. They say God's love is literally true and God's wrath is not. It's a projection of our own wrath. Julian of Norwich was deeply disturbed by the idea of God's wrath, so she asked God to show her his wrath, and he did, and she wrote, "I saw no wrath but on man's part." The defender could also say that God really has wrath, but it's directed only to sins and not to sinners. And it's directed to sins precisely because of his love for sinners. As you hate the cancer that is killing somebody that you love, and the more you love the victim, the more you hate the cancer. And according to the believer's religion, that's exactly what we're supposed to do. Love sinners more, and therefore hate sin more, just like God. So you at least have consistency. Whether God exists or not, the concept of God is not the concept of a cosmic hypocrite, but a God who practices what he preaches. But if God's wrath is not objectively real, does that mean that hell is also not objectively real? Couldn't all the language about hell be interpreted non-literally? Language about God is inevitably non-literal since God can't be seen, so we should be able to do the same with hell since that also is not visible. So the fires of hell should be interpreted just as non-literally as the wrath of God is. Well, it certainly seems reasonable to interpret language about the nature of any invisible thing non-literally, whether that thing is God or hell or heaven, but you can't interpret language about the existence of something non-literally, whether it's God or hell or heaven. And it seems pretty clear from the Bible and the Quran that whatever the nature of hell consists of, its existence is real. So how is that compatible with the God of love? One bold answer from many of the saints and mystics is that the fires of hell are made of the love of God. that it is the very love of God for the sinner that tortures them in hell, because the sinner is in hell only because he's made himself the enemy of love. And God's love tortures his egotism, but God can't turn off his love any more than the sun can turn off its light. The sinner is like a small child in a fit of rage. He hates his parents and wishes they'd fight with him so he could feel self-righteous, but instead they forgive him and hug him and kiss him and tell him they love him, and that's torture to the kid. Or take an adult example. The very beauty of a great piece of music may be torture to someone who's blindly jealous of the composer. Here is a third objection to belief in hell. No one would want to go to hell, so those who go there must go there against their will. But that contradicts the doctrine of free will. If we're thrown into hell by God against our will, that would mean God overrides our free will, even if that were just, and we'll argue in a later argument that it couldn't be just. If, on the other hand, we choose hell by our own free will, we would have to be insane to prefer eternal misery to eternal joy. And it's difficult to believe human beings could be that insane. And if they are that insane, they shouldn't be held responsible for their insane choices. They're sick and in need of therapy, not hell. So we have this dilemma. If hell is involuntary, it's unfair to our free choice, and we're back with the picture of a sadistic, evil God. And if it's voluntary, it's also unfair because it punishes the insane with eternal, hopeless torture. And again, we have the picture of a sadistic God. The first possibility seems impossible, God rewarding people's choice of heaven with a condemnation to hell. So the only answer must be the second one, that hell is our free choice. So the question then becomes, how could we be that insane? That's a hard question to answer rationally, but perhaps there are clues. If we're honest, perhaps we must admit that we often are insane. We do prefer misery to joy. We know, not by religious faith, but by repeated experience and human reason, that whenever we're good and honest and loving and unselfish and above all forgiving, that makes us happy. And whenever we're wicked and dishonest and hateful and selfish and unforgiving, that makes us miserable. It doesn't take a religious authority or even a great philosopher like Plato to convince us that justice is always more profitable than injustice. We know saints are happy, and yet we're not saints. What makes this credible is not so much a clearer definition, but a clearer self-understanding. And sometimes challenging fiction can give us that. For instance, I recommend C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, which is a witty updating of Dante's Divine Comedy that shows us the psychology of damnation through a fantasy about a bus trip from hell to heaven, a heaven that proves surprisingly uncomfortable. A fourth objection is how any good and loving person could ever be happy in heaven if they knew any of their friends that they love are in hell. That's a very difficult question to answer. Logically, it seems there's only three possibilities. Either they don't know there is anyone in hell, but then their happiness is based on a lie, or else they do know this and they're happy about it, but then they're selfish, unfeeling stinkers who shouldn't be in heaven, or else they know it and they're not happy about it, in which case heaven is not perfect because its inhabitants are unhappy. The only two answers I can imagine to this objection are to deny that there are any people in hell that ought to be pitied, or else to deny that the people in heaven ought to pity them. If there are souls in hell, they might not be persons anymore, but only ex-persons who have lost their personality, their I, their very ability to say I. When a great painting falls into the fireplace and burns, it's no longer a great painting, but ashes. So perhaps in hell you make an ash of yourself, an ex-person. But it's still right for us to mourn over the loss of something precious, like a burned painting. So why wouldn't heaven mourn over hell? Perhaps because their time experience would be so different from ours, because they'd live in the present all the time and not in the dead past to be mourned over. Regret, after all, presupposes the kind of this-worldly time which is relative to matter and space. So we probably shouldn't think of heaven and hell as parallel places in the same time, like Golden Gate Park and Alcatraz. There may be other kinds of time. Even in this world, time is surprisingly multidimensional and relative. It would be irrational to believe that one damned soul in hell could eternally blackmail all the loving souls in heaven and destroy their joy. But it's difficult to imagine how this could be. Of course, our inability to imagine it doesn't mean it can't happen, unless our imagination is the criterion for what can be. But we need some hint or clue, at least. Perhaps that's the distinction between passive love, which can be blackmailed, and active love, which can't. When someone we love does something self-destructive, like getting hooked on drugs or attempting suicide, we say to them, "How could you do this?" I think we're really saying two things there. How could you do that to yourself? And also, how could you do that to me? Our active will to their good says the first thing, but our passive love, our own emotional hurt, says the second thing. Perhaps in heaven, our active will would still will their good, but our emotions would not be passive and vulnerable and blackmailable. Just a suggestion. No one can know. A fifth objection is that if there is a hell, it must be just, but it's not merciful, so justice would trump mercy. But God's mercy is supposed to be more prominent than his justice in the scriptures of all three religions. For instance, the most repeated name for Allah in the Quran is the compassionate, the merciful. This objection about justice and mercy may make us rethink the relation between those two virtues. We usually think of mercy as a relaxation of justice, a compromising of justice, even a contradiction to justice. But if both are divine attributes, then justice can no more be compromised or contradicted than mercy can. Justice wouldn't prevent God from extending mercy and forgiveness, but it would prevent him from treating the refusal of that mercy in the same way as the acceptance of it. Justice has to be honest and has to discriminate between those who accept mercy and those who don't. If it didn't do that, that would be like giving the Nobel Peace Prize to Stalin. God couldn't tell such lies. God could forgive, but forgiving doesn't mean condoning. Condoning means pretending it's not as bad as it is. Forgiveness neither condones nor condemns. But forgiveness is a gift. It's freely given, and it has to be freely accepted. If not, you don't have it. Jewish, Christian, and Muslim scriptures say that hell is punishment. But there are two kinds of punishment, because there are two kinds of law. There's positive law and natural law. Positive law is law that's posited or willed by some will, human or divine, some will that chose to make that law but could have chosen differently. Natural laws are not willed, and they couldn't be different. They're necessary because they're the laws of the nature of a thing, whether a physical thing or a spiritual thing. Don't drive on the left is a positive law in America, but not England. If you jump off a cliff, you'll break your bones is a natural law. Remember to think about your tax return each year is a positive law. Those who think have curiosity is a natural law. If you steal that cookie, I'll send you to bed without supper is a positive law. If you eat too many cookies, you'll get a stomach ache is a natural law. Now, the punishments for violating positive laws are changeable and negotiable, like going to bed without supper because you stole cookies. And mercy can change those laws and those punishments. But the punishments for violating natural laws are unchangeable and necessary. Mercy can't change them. If you jump off a cliff, gravity can't be merciful to you. So hell would seem to contradict God's mercy if it were his positive law, but not if it were the natural and necessary punishment for being a contrary to God kind of person. C.S. Lewis puts it this way. He writes, "We are at liberty to think of the bad man's perdition not as a sentence imposed upon him, but as the mere fact of being himself. Our egotist has turned everything into a province or appendage of the self. The taste for the other, that is, the very capacity for enjoying good, is quenched in him, except insofar as his body still draws him into some contact with the outer world. Death removes this last contact. He has his wish, to live wholly in himself and to make the best of what he finds there, and what he finds there is hell." I think what Lewis is saying in that quotation is that hell is not an added punishment for being evil, but the very state of being evil come to fruition and eternalized. And that heaven is not an added reward for being good, but the very state of being good made perfect and eternalized. so that the saying, virtue is its own reward and vice is its own punishment, would then be true not only in time, but also in eternity. The objector may say that this rather sophisticated and psychological kind of hell doesn't seem too bad, not nearly as bad as the popular image of torture chambers full of gleeful demons inserting hot pitchforks into unrepentant posteriors. But the believer might reply, it's far worse, if spiritual joys are greater than physical joys. For then spiritual sufferings would be worse than physical sufferings. It seems that our souls can both enjoy and suffer in deeper and subtler ways than our bodies. Evidence for this, that internal pain can be worse than external pain, seems to be the fact that when we have deep internal pain, spiritual pain so deep as to be despair, we often do two very stupid-seeming things. We hit our head against the wall, and we pull out our hair. Why do we do that? Why in the world would we add physical pain to the spiritual pain? Probably because it's not as bad as the spiritual pain, and it distracts us from that worse pain. Dostoevsky says, hell is the suffering of being unable to love. If love is the greatest joy, then lovelessness would be the greatest suffering. In other words, it would be exactly the opposite of Sartre's vision in No Exit, that hell is other people. A sixth objection against the idea of hell could come from the premise of predestination. If God knows everything, including all futures, he predestines everyone. In fact, the word predestination is in the Bible. But if God predestines some people to hell before they're born, then we're back with the moral monster, the cosmic sadist, who wills some people to be damned for all eternity. The answer to that objection, I think, has to be some redefinition of predestination. It can't literally be pre-anything because God is not in time. We made that point in an earlier lecture. And I don't think there can be a double predestination, two equal predestinations of some to heaven and others to hell, because a good God would not will anyone's damnation. In fact, that's what the Bible says. In the New Testament, God does not will any to perish, but for all to come to salvation. So heaven would fulfill God's will, and hell would not. But that would lead to a seventh objection. If God wills everyone to be saved, and not all are, then God doesn't get what he wills. And in that case, he is not omnipotent. The answer to this has to go back to what we said about the problem of evil, that God's omnipotence can't meaningfully extend to self-contradictions. And to force people to freely choose heaven would be a self-contradiction. That seems logical. But a second part of the answer might seem paradoxical, that it would take greater power, not less, for God to create free children rather than puppets or robots. So the answer could be that when a human soul chooses hell, God's will is indeed defeated, but, to quote C.S. Lewis again, what you call defeat, I call miracle, for to make things which are not itself, and thus to become, in a sense, capable of being resisted by its own handiwork, is the most astonishing and unimaginable of all the feats we attribute to the deity. And if the objector replies that that's not what he means by omnipotence, the believer could answer that that's what God means by omnipotence. Or, to put his point more fairly, the unbeliever's model of omnipotence is really a control freak rather than a parent. A related objection concerning God's omnipotence might be this. If God is all good and all powerful, he must have chosen to create the best of all possible worlds. To prefer a worse world to a better one would not be to be as good as he could be. But it would have been better for God to have created a world in which there is no hell, or a world in which no one chooses hell. So this is not the best of all possible worlds. The answer should be to examine the concept of the best of all possible worlds. Is this a consistent concept, or is there a self-contradiction in it, like the concept of the highest finite number? There can be no such thing as the highest finite number. You can always add one more to any finite number, however high it is. So you could always make a better finite world, no matter how good it is. For instance, as one writer said, God could have created a world with a better berry than the strawberry, but he didn't. Or the believer might remembering that a good offense is the best defense, tried to answer the charge by going on the attack and asking the unbeliever what God could have done better. How could he make a better world? By not making a hell? But he didn't make it. We make it. If it's interpreted symbolically, not as a place, but as a condition of soul, a negative relationship to God. And then the only way God could destroy hell would be by destroying the possibility of our making it, and that means destroying free will. Or, more simply, the answer to why God didn't create a world without a hell could be simply that he did, but we messed it up and created hell. The fact that it's obviously not the best of all possible worlds is our fault, not God's. An eighth objection is that hell seems contrary not only to love and mercy, but also to justice. The punishment does not seem to fit the crime. Quantitatively, infinite and eternal punishments for finite and temporal crimes. Let's divide the objection into three parts. The unjust relation between temporal crimes and eternal punishments, between finite crimes and infinite punishments, and between relatively mild crimes and infinitely intense and horrible punishments. First, we have to look at the time and eternity problem again. If eternity means not time, rather than more time, or even endless time, then the concept of eternity is not a quantitative concept. It means another dimension than time. If that's what we enter at death, the quantitative problem is irrelevant. To use a crude image, if we've made squares of ourselves in time, eternity wouldn't make them bigger squares, but it would make us cubes. If we made ourselves triangles in time, eternity would reveal us as pyramids. In other words, the relation between earthly choices and eternal rewards and punishments would not be like the relation between crimes and the length of prison sentences, but more like the relation between a foundation and a building. The person after death would be the same person as the person before death, but with another dimension. Somewhat as the person after birth is the same person as before birth, but with more dimensions. So, if eternity is not quantitative, we can't calculate the quantity of eternal punishment. But the second objection says it's unjust to have infinite punishments for finite crimes. So hell's punishments would have to be finite rather than infinite. The formula for justice is the punishment fits the crime. And that implies that both the crime and the punishment are finite, because fits the crime means proportionate to the crime, and all proportion is finite. Only God is infinite. So justice would have to entail something like this. If one saint in heaven has a soul that is more large and loving than another, then that soul would be able to contain more of God or reflect more of God's joy than another. So in a parallel way, one soul in hell would be more deep set in pride and despair and hate than another, and therefore more miserable. And that would be just. Again, it's a natural law justice rather than a positive law justice. Third, the defender of hell might answer the objection that hell's punishments are too intense for their crimes by saying that this is imagery. Intense images, like fire, are meant to suggest, not to define. Hell is unimaginable, and that doesn't mean it's milder. It's probably more awful than our literal misinterpretation of those images. We've made that point already in contrasting physical pain and spiritual pain. But the objection still stands, despite those distinctions. The punishment seems far worse than the crime. The only answer to that has to be that the punishment is the crime itself come to fruition. Remember that C.S. Lewis quote about the complete egotist who has no taste for the other. Or the believer might reply that if you understood the meaning of just two terms, you wouldn't see hell's punishment as not fitting to sin's crime. The two terms are God and sin. Sin doesn't mean the same thing as evil. It's a religious word. It's a relational word. It designates not just the violation of a rule or a law, but a negative relationship to God, a kind of deliberate divorce from God, a God who by definition is the only game in town, the one and only first cause and last end, and the source of all good and joy and love. So the believer would say, if you object to hell as too severe a punishment for sin, you don't understand what sin is. You probably look at it externally, sociologically, as behaving badly, but that's only its visible dimension. The real badness of it is its invisible dimension. The visible relationship to other people and their behavior is only the manifestation, the symptom of the disease. And the more beautiful God is, the more ugly sin would be by definition. A ninth objection might be that hell is ridiculously overpopulated. Most Jews, Christians, and Muslims have traditionally believed that more people will go to hell than to heaven. Jesus even seems to teach that when he says that the way to hell is wide and that many find it, but the way to heaven is narrow and only few find it. But that would be a divine defeat. More souls for Satan than for God. More losses than wins. The simplest answer to that is no one knows the population statistics. When Jesus' disciples asked him the question, "Lord, will many be saved?" he answered, "Neither yes nor no, but strive to enter in." But what about what he said about the narrow way and the few that find it? Well, look at the context. Look at your data. What did Jesus call God? Was it statistician or demographer? Or was it father? Well, follow out that image. If you're the father of 10 kids and one dies tragically, that's one too many. And the 9 left are one too few. The objection that hell is overpopulated seems to assume the premise that life is a game played by God and the devil, and the one who ends up with the most souls wins. That premise is not part of the religious hypothesis that's in question. And how could we judge when hell is overpopulated? By what standard? Where is the line to be drawn, and by whom? It's like the problem of evil. How much evil is too much to be compatible with the goodness of God? Logically, the only two possible answers are either any at all or none at all. Either that any evil and any damned soul refutes God, or that no amount of evil and no amount of damned souls does. We naturally feel that at some finite point it just becomes too much. But this is a feeling that we can't really translate into reason. We can't give a reason for drawing a line anywhere. A tenth and final objection to hell is practical. What are the results of believing it? By your fruits you shall know them. If we apply this principle to beliefs as well as persons, we should be very suspicious of hell. Hell has produced such fear and hate and despair and oppression that it fairly cries out that it was made in fear and hate and despair and the desire to oppress and control people. The defender might first question the objector's implicit assumption that those who believe in hell want it to exist, as if doctrines were not objective facts but subjective personal choices. It's certainly true that the doctrine has been used to oppress and control people, but any idea, true or false, can be misused. That does not prove it is false. The abuse does not take away the proper use. But the objector can fairly demand to know what this proper use is. And the answer would have to be something like the same as the proper use of ideas like death or thin ice. The fear saves lives and saves happiness. And if the idea of hell were true, we would have to compare the harm that has often come from believing in it with the harm that has come from not believing in it. So the objection really presupposes that the idea is not true. And the defender is really presupposing that it is. So neither side has proved its case without presuppositions. But the objector might argue that the result is not a draw in this case, that his case is stronger than the believer's because the main result of believing in hell is fear, and fear is harmful. But the defender could reply that when there are real dangers, a lack of fear is more harmful than fear. On a battlefield, it is right to feel afraid and not secure. So both sides' arguments still depend on their presuppositions. The fact that hell produces fear could even be used by the defender as an argument for the existence of hell, an argument parallel to the argument from desire for the existence of heaven. The argument from the fear of hell to the existence of hell, and the argument for the desire for heaven to the existence of heaven, both use the same premise, that any innate natural desire always corresponds to a real object. Since fear is correlative to desire, since we fear to lose whatever we desire to have, and desire to lose whatever we fear to have, the same premise could be used, substituting fear for desire. And then if you add the minor premise that we have a natural fear of hell parallel to a natural desire for heaven, the conclusion would be that both would have to be real. But is this minor premise true? Is there an innate fear of hell? That's hard to prove. We do seem to find that fear expressed in many different cultures and religions and places and times, so it seems pretty universal and innate. But do we find it in ourselves? At this point, as with the argument about heaven, I think we can only appeal to our own honesty and ask ourselves this question. Isn't the deepest reason we fear death, isn't the thing we fear the most in death, the possibility of hell? Are we absolutely certain that it does not exist and that we cannot possibly go there? But you must answer that question for yourself. These arguments did not intend to answer the question for you, but I hope this lecture is at least a tool for you to do just that. In the next lecture, we will look at the case for life after death and see the strengths and weaknesses of 20 arguments for it.
This ends Lecture 9. Questions of Faith, Lecture 10. Different Concepts of Heaven.
We could summarize the two most important claims of the three major Western religions as God and immortality. We examined 20 arguments for God a few lectures ago. In this one, we'll examine 12 arguments for immortality, or life after death. I have arranged these 12 arguments for life after death in an order, from what seemed to me to be the weakest to the strongest. Of course, there are various standards of strength and weakness, as we'll see when we evaluate these arguments, and differences of opinion about which arguments are stronger and which are weaker. I begin with two arguments from authority. According to a maxim of the medieval philosophers, arguments from authority are always the weakest kinds of arguments. They're not proofs, they don't claim certainty, but they are arguments, and they claim probability, at least. And they're probably the commonest of all the arguments that most of us use most of the time. Most of the reasons most people have for believing most of the things they believe about anything are that we trust the authority of parents, teachers, textbooks, experts, society, friends, etc. The first is the argument from consensus. It's simply that the vast majority of all people who have ever lived have believed in some form of life after death. So this argument consults what Chesterton calls the democracy of the dead and extends the franchise to all people who have ever lived. It's similar to the common consent argument for God. Its strongest form is probably the point that in order to disbelieve, you have to be something like an intellectual snob. A second argument appeals to quality rather than quantity. It's that most of the great sages, the wise, have believed in life after death. Thinkers considered wise for other reasons have also believed in life after death, so it seems unlikely that this one belief of theirs should be the exception to their wisdom. Arguments from reason are stronger than arguments from authority, and these arguments from reason can be subdivided into those that take their data or evidence from the subhuman, from the human, or from the superhuman. From nature, from human nature, or from God. The arguments that take their evidence from nature are the weakest arguments because nature offers the weakest clues. One of the simplest arguments from nature, so simple that I think no philosopher has paid much attention to it, but so simple that it's probably the earliest, most primitive argument for life after death and the most obvious reason for believing there's some sort of soul that might survive the death of the body, is one that I like to call primitive man's argument from dead cow. Primitive man has two cows. One dies. So he questions his data. He asks the question, what's the difference now between these two cows? The difference is certainly very great. So great that primitive man has to invent two different words for the two different cows, live cow and dead cow. Dead means lacking whatever live has. But what is that? What makes live cow alive? What method does primitive man use to answer that question? A brilliantly simple one, one that might not occur to a philosopher. He looks at his data. He examines the two cows. There's no material difference in size or weight or color or organs. Not an ear or an eye or a hoof or an udder is missing. Dead cow's body is still utterly complete. Yet something is clearly missing. What is it? What gave this cow life? What hypothesis could explain the data? The answer seems obvious to primitive man. Life is what makes live cow breathe. The word for life, or soul, in many ancient languages is the same word as the word for breath. Not that life is air, but the power to move air through the lungs. There's still air in dead cow's lungs, but no breath. The word soul can mean a number of different things. It can mean, as it does in most ancient languages, the source of life for any living body, plant or animal or human. Or it can mean, as it does to most of us today, the distinctively human soul, which can think and choose, the source of self-consciousness and personality. Primitive man's argument from dead cow uses the term soul in the primitive sense, the broader sense. So primitive man discovers that life is not a material thing like an organ. It is the life of the organs, that which makes them all cooperate for the health of the whole body. That's what's gone from dead cow. But if this soul gives life, then it doesn't borrow life as bodies do. Bodies can be either living bodies or dead bodies, depending on whether or not they have souls. But souls can't lose their life and die as bodies do. If they did, they'd have to die by losing their soul. But how can soul lose soul? The weakness of this primitive argument is that it proves both too much and too little. Too much because it seems to prove that every cow and every bacteria and every plant is immortal, since all have souls in the sense of life. Well, perhaps everything is immortal, but that's not what most people believe. And to believe that would lead to silly questions like, where are all the dead mosquitoes after death? Although, as C.S. Lewis says, that question can be answered on its own level by pointing out that a hell for men and a heaven for mosquitoes could quite efficiently be combined. Or if you embrace the other half of the dilemma and say that it is not each individual plant soul and animal soul that is immortal, but only soul in general, or life in general, then the argument proves too little, for it doesn't prove the immortality of any individual soul at all, whether human or animal. And it also doesn't distinguish the human soul from the animal soul, so it doesn't give any reason for the common belief that all human souls live on after death, but not all animal souls. So this argument cannot prove human life after death. What good is it then? Well, it seems to show two things, that there are souls, that strict materialism is inadequate, and therefore either souls don't die as bodies do, or that if they do, they don't die in the same way that bodies do, because they're not bodies. The next argument I like to call the argument from magic. I use that word just to get your attention and help you to remember the argument by giving it an unusual label. The argument is really extraordinarily ordinary. It begins with the daily experience of what I call magic, the power of mind over matter. For example, all of us can levitate, and all of us have magic wands. What is it to levitate? To violate the law of gravity by commanding your body, by willpower and thought, to rise up into the air. What is it to use a magic wand? It is to touch heavy objects with the wand and make them to levitate. Well, every time you jump, you levitate. And every time you lift something, you use your magic wand. It's called your arm. This is not meant to be a trick. If there were no such thing as a mind or a will behind your legs and arms, you couldn't do this magic. When you die, you won't be able to do this anymore, even though the matter in your arms and legs remains. When you die, your body will be like a sword dropped by a mortally wounded swordsman. It falls to the ground, and it can no longer levitate. What is it that can do this mind-over-matter magic? Not sheer matter, but mind. Therefore, we are more than sheer matter. We are mind. And what is more than matter is not subject to the laws of matter, such as mortality. So there can be something in us that is not mortal. This argument is similar to primitive man's argument from dead cow, and its weakness, I think, is also similar. All it does is it shows us there's something more than strict materialism in us. It doesn't prove that that something is immortal. Matter is mortal, soul is not matter, therefore soul is not mortal, is a fallacious argument. If you've taken logic, you'll recognize that as the fallacy of illicit major. Just because the soul can't die as the body dies, that doesn't prove that it can't die at all. Here is an argument from Book 10 of Plato's Republic. It's basically an argument from the soul's ability to survive all of its diseases. Plato begins by observing that every thing has its own natural intrinsic evil that corrupts it and weakens it and eventually destroys it. For instance, rust for iron, mildew for wood, disease for the human body, eye diseases for the eye. He then argues that if anything is destroyed completely, it must be destroyed either by its own intrinsic natural evil, or by what is evil for some other thing, or by what is not evil at all. But the soul is not destroyed by its own intrinsic evils. Soul vices, spiritual vices, intellectual and moral vices, ignorance and wickedness. No matter how stupid or wicked you are, you still think and choose. But if souls aren't destroyed by their own natural evils, much less can they be destroyed by what is evil for some other nature, including the body. Body and soul have different natures. What destroys one doesn't destroy the other. As fire burns oil but doesn't burn water, or sunlight evaporates water but doesn't evaporate oil. That is a clever argument, but it seems to have two weaknesses. First, it assumes that souls and bodies are two totally different things, like oil and water. Fire, which destroys oil by burning it, doesn't burn water, and sunlight, which evaporates water, doesn't evaporate oil. But perhaps soul and body are two dimensions of one person, like the meaning and the syllables of a book, or the matter and the form of the statue. And a second weakness of Plato's argument is it shows that souls are never destroyed in this life while bodies are alive, but it does not show what happens afterwards. Another argument begins with the observation that souls, unlike bodies, are not composed of parts. You can cut a body in half, but not a soul. You can have bad souls or weak souls, but you can't have half a soul. Now, whatever is composed of parts can decompose into its parts. A molecule into atoms, a cell into molecules, an organ into cells, a body into organs, a person into body and soul. But what is not composed of parts cannot be decomposed. So the soul cannot be decomposed. Now, there are only two conceivable ways for anything to be destroyed: by being decomposed into its parts, as bodies are, or by being annihilated as a whole. But nothing is annihilated as a whole. Nothing simply pops out of existence, any more than anything simply pops into existence. So if souls can't die either by decomposition or by annihilation, they can't die at all. The weakness of this argument, I think, is that we cannot be sure that there is no third way for a soul to die besides decomposition or annihilation. Nor can we be sure that annihilation is not possible for souls, just because it is not possible for bodies. Still another argument is from the soul's power to objectify the body. The soul can make the body its object. It can know the body. The body can be an object of knowledge. Where does this power come from? How could it come from the body? The body cannot objectify itself, that is, be its own object of knowledge or know itself, because the self that knows objects cannot be one of the objects known. The knowledge of a thing is not one of that thing's parts. The projecting machine cannot be one of the objects of its own light. It projects images on the screen. It can't be one of those images. Therefore, there is at least this one power of the soul that cannot come from the body. And that means that it is not wholly subject to the laws of the body, including mortality. A closely related argument would be from memory. I can remember my own past. I can objectify my past. When I was living those events that I now remember, I was the subject of those events and of the experiencing of them. Now, in memory, I make these subjective events objects to myself. I must be more than my past in order to remember my past. My past is dead. Only my present is alive. A corollary of this argument, then, would seem to be that I can never completely know myself as an object. For in order to know anything, I must transcend it, and it is a logical contradiction to say that I transcend myself. A similar argument is based on the distinction we all understand between being and having. I have things like shoes. I also have feelings and thoughts and a body. But I am the self that has these things. The haver is more than the had. But my body is had. Therefore, I am more than my body. I possess it. Therefore, I can lose it by death. But I cannot lose my self, my I. And if that's the soul, I cannot lose my soul. That which possesses objects is not an object possessed, and that which is not possessed cannot be unpossessed or lost. As the Tao Te Ching puts it, there is no death spot in you, no place for death to insert itself between you and your soul, as there is a spot between you and your body. The objector can point out that when we speak of our soul, we seem to objectify the soul, and thus to indicate a gap between the self and the soul. Yes, but that objectification of your soul must be done by something. Let's call it the self. If you say the soul is part of your objective nature, part of your what, part of your essence, you must also say that you are not only a what, you are also a who has that essence. So if you don't want to call it soul, call it I or self. But that's still a meaningful distinction between your what and your who. Your what comes from nature. That's your essence. Heredity and environment gives it to you, and nature can take that away. But nature doesn't give you your who, and therefore nature can't take it away. As C.S. Lewis said, reflecting on his dead wife in his diary, A Grief Observed, "If she is not now, then she never was. I mistook a cloud of atoms for a person." To put the argument most briefly, if I am not immortal, I am not an I. This argument is very hard to argue about because it is the unfolding of an understanding of the shortest and most mysterious word in our language, the word I. Here's another argument. It's the argument from the soul's two immaterial operations. This is the favorite argument of medieval scholastic philosophers like Thomas Aquinas. He argues we can perform two operations that matter cannot perform, thinking and choosing. Take thinking first. It's not sensing or imagining, which is internal sensing. Our thought transcends images. That's why we can do math. We imagine only concrete things like pyramids, but we can conceive abstract things like trigonometry. We can imagine the difference between a three-sided figure and a four-sided figure, but we cannot imagine the difference between a 103-sided figure and a 104-sided figure, unless we have remarkably detailed imaginations, and yet we can all understand the difference between a 103-sided figure and a 104-sided figure. We can calculate the angles in both. Therefore, our understanding transcends our imagining. And in a parallel way, our willing transcends our instinctive desiring. If that were not so, there could be no responsibility and no morality. You don't moralize to machines or even to animals. If you're not in control of something, you're not responsible for it. Without free will, there's no responsibility and no morality. And thus all the moral words of praising and blaming and counseling and commanding would be meaningless. Also, if we only have animal instincts and not free choice, then the strongest instinct in us would always win. But sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes we choose to follow the weaker instinct, like compassion rather than fear and self-preservation, when we see a little old lady being mugged. We can choose contrary to our strongest instinct. Therefore, we are more than instinct. Now, imagining and instinctive desiring are both animal functions and depend on matter. But abstract thinking and free choice are not. The cause of those two operations must be something more than our animal organism, even though we use our animal organism as our instruments. We use our brain to think. So we must be more than our body and brain. We must be also some non-bodily something, usually called a soul. and things not made of body don't die of bodily causes. More technically, the argument can be put this way. Only an immaterial thing can perform immaterial acts, and the human soul can perform two immaterial acts of abstract thinking and free deliberate choosing. Therefore, the human soul is immaterial. And what is immaterial cannot be killed by material causes. Therefore, the human soul is not killed by immaterial causes and can survive the death of the body. There are also some arguments from the nature of God to the immortality of the soul. In one sense, these arguments are the weakest of all the arguments because they don't convince many people, since most people who don't believe in immortality don't believe in God either, so they can just deny the premise of the argument. But in another sense, these are the strongest arguments, because if God exists, then he would be the real cause of the soul's immortality if he designed and created souls. So this argument, if it works, would tell you the real reason, the real cause, for its conclusion. Most arguments reason from the effect back to the cause. This one reasons from the cause forward to the effect. You could argue that the soul is immortal because of God's love. If you love a person, you don't want them to cease to exist. We're commanded to love our neighbor, to have goodwill to our neighbor, so if I love you, I want you to live and not to die forever. So if there is a God who loves us, he would want us to live forever. Does God love us less than we love each other? Is he this cosmic hypocrite not practicing what he preaches? That would be inconsistent. The argument from justice begins with the premise that often injustice rather than justice is the last word in this life. Not everyone gets what they deserve in this world. In the words of Vince Lombardi, good guys finish last. It took the Red Sox 86 years to win a world championship. So, since justice is not fulfilled in the short run, it must be fulfilled in the long run. And that means there must be a long run, a life after death. But the objector might question, why must justice be fulfilled in the long run? That's the premise that can easily be doubted. To prove that premise, we need to look deeper into ourselves. And when we do, we often find an absolute demand for justice. If we were writing the story of human life, we certainly wouldn't end it with the villains being rewarded and the heroes being punished. And then, if you throw God into the argument, you ask, is God less just than we are? Or less loving than we are? Does he kill us in the end, even though he commands us not to kill each other? If you believe in God, that can be a strong argument for immortality. But since most people who don't believe in immortality don't believe in God either, that would make it a very weak argument for immortality. So can we patch it up so that it doesn't need the premise of God? Well, let's see. Let's look at this absolute non-negotiable demand that we all make for justice, at least in the long run, whether we believe in God or not. This demand is either subjective or objective. That is, it's either a subjective quirk of the human psyche, a personal preference, like chocolate versus vanilla, or it's a fact about objective reality. It either tells us only something about us, like I feel sick when I see you killing innocent people, or else it tells us also something about reality, like no one should really kill innocent people. If you believe the first, you are a moral subjectivist. You believe that our deepest moral judgments are expressions of our own subjective feelings or desires, whether individually or collectively. But then, it's difficult for you to give any reason to take morality more seriously than you take other subjective preferences that come from your own desires, or the rules of any other game that come from the desires of a group. In that case, you can't really argue about morality any more than you can argue about tastes in foods or sports. Nobody can ever be really right or wrong. If, on the other hand, you believe that moral judgments can be objective, that when you say you really should do justice, that you're making a statement about a dimension of objective reality, then you're implying that objective reality contains more than just what you can see with your physical senses. It includes also what you can see with your conscience and your moral reason. And then you can argue that justice demands immortality. How would that argument go? It's not easy to formulate because it depends on an additional insight, a seeing that it's quite easy to deny, and if you deny it, I see no way to prove it by logical reasoning. The insight, or the seeing, is the insight into the intrinsic value of a person. That persons are not means but ends, and that's why it's wrong to use them as means to your own good and ignore what's good for them. That's the reason why slavery or genocide or cannibalism or robbery or rape are seriously wrong. Now, some people simply don't believe that anything is really right or wrong. They believe that right and wrong are just expressions of desire or preference or feeling or choice, so this argument won't work on them. They're the moral subjectivists. Others believe that these things really are wrong, but not because of the intrinsic value of the person, but for some other reason, and the argument won't work then either. I don't know what other reason they'd give. Perhaps they'd simply say they don't know why they're bad, but they're bad. Or they might say these things are bad because God says so. They're divine moral subjectivists. They'd say that if God said murder is good and justice is bad, then murder really would be good and justice really would be bad, period, for no other reason than that. And if you believe that, then this argument won't work either. But suppose you believe that every person has an intrinsic value and not just a useful value, that each person is indispensable, and that this is objectively true and that you can know it. Then you could argue that it is intolerable that the indispensable be dispensed with, that persons be treated like used car parts or dirty diapers. You are as indispensable as I am. But why couldn't this morally intolerable situation be real? A lot of morally intolerable situations are real in this world. Unjust wars. Because if this were real, then in the long run and universally, not just temporally in terms of a war for a few years, ultimately reality would do to persons in the end what is morally intolerable, whether reality in the end means God or not. And then our deepest moral judgments would no longer have any ground in reality. They would be merely our preferences, and that would turn us into moral subjectivists. What we admitted were objectively real oughts would really be only facts about what we deeply wish or will or want. This argument from justice to immortality is fragile because its force depends almost wholly on two truths that are seen by intuition rather than proved by argument. One, that persons have intrinsic value, and two, that morality must be grounded in some dimension of objective reality and not just in our own subjective desires. So the argument doesn't so much prove immortality as show the price that has to be paid to deny it. You have to give up either the intrinsic value of the person or the objective truth of a morality of justice. And the argument might also show you a way to check it out, to verify it. That is, it gives you something like a laboratory experiment to make. The experiment would be love. Not sentimental love, but tough love. Not puppy love or yuppie love, but costly love. Or as Dostoevsky says, not love in dreams, but love in action. Love in dreams is the love that is blind. Love in action is the love that is not blind, the love that has an eye in it. As Pascal says, the heart has reasons that the reason does not know. The heart has eyes, not just feelings. The experiment then would be, if you treat your neighbor with tough love, if you treat your neighbor as if he or she had intrinsic value, then you will see that it is true. In the words of Dostoevsky from the Brothers Karamazov, insofar as you advance in the love of your neighbor, you will grow surer of the immortality of the soul. This has been tried. This is certain. Perhaps the surest way to be convinced of immortality is not an argument, but that experiment. One last reason for believing in life after death is not a philosophical argument, but an event. At least 15 million Americans claim to have had some kind of near-death experience. Everyone who has had this experience has come back from it quite convinced that there is life after death. The experience usually happens either during a medical crisis when the heart stops for a few minutes, and sometimes the brain stops too, and then the patient comes back, often through CPR, or else it is triggered by the anticipation of death, as in a narrowly averted car accident or a fall. The pattern is by now very well known. The tunnel, the bright light, the being of light, the border, the experience of being totally known and totally loved. This experience could be an illusion or a hallucination, of course, but there are some features of the experience that argue for its truth. First, it doesn't vary much by personality. Almost everyone sees parts of the same pattern. And second, the pattern isn't what they expect. No golden streets, angels, clouds, harps, or halos. And third, they're usually drug-free, so it can't be explained chemically. And fourth, while they're supposedly out of their bodies, they sometimes report having seen things that turn out later to be true. And fifth, and most impressive of all, they return to life changed. And the changes are very good ones, unlike the results of hallucinations or drugs or dreams. I think you can see four very big changes that are almost always present. They don't become saints or morally perfect people, but they do become wise in four ways. First, they know there is life after death. There's no doubt. No one wonders whether it was only a dream. Second, there's no fear. They no longer fear death. And that's a remarkable psychological change. Third, they all know they were sent back for a reason. And so they have a very strong sense of purpose and direction and meaning in their lives. And fourth, they all have a new set of values. They all say that only two things in life matter absolutely, because only these two things carry over into the next life. There are only two things you can take with you, and they're truth and love, or wisdom and compassion, knowing and loving other people without limit, as they experience being known and loved by this indefinable being of light. And that's very impressive. And Christians, religious Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, and even open-minded agnostics and skeptics all find their own deepest convictions ratified and not violated by this experience. Wisdom and compassion are precisely the two highest values in Buddhism, prajna and karuna. And spiritual knowledge and spiritual love are the two powers of the soul that medieval philosophers like Thomas Aquinas used to prove immortality. They're the two things we can do and animals can't. There are, of course, many questions that can be asked about this near-death experience. Can't it be explained as a trick of brain chemistry, or an innate wish-fulfillment illusion from the collective unconscious, or in some other way? And perhaps it can. No matter how strong the evidence, it can always be doubted. It doesn't amount to a conclusive proof. If it did, the only people who would not be convinced by it would be people who were either ignorant of the facts, or too stupid to understand the logic, or pig-headed enough to reject a clear proof. Religious ideas can be argued about. They're truth claims, and there's good argument based on evidence both for and against them. And there's always a role for faith, for free choice to believe or not to believe. I know of no argument in the philosophy of religion that is so mathematically certain that it closes the case forever. In the next lecture, we'll test some specific truth claims of some specific religions.
This ends Lecture 10.